book on a side table. He leans back in the chair to meditate, enjoying the only quiet and solitary moments he will know this day. Lincoln traipses down the hall to his office. His desk is mahogany with cubbies and shelves. Behind him is the willow-lined Potomac, seen clearly outside the window. Secretaries John Nicolay and John Hay have laid the mail on the desk, having already removed the love letters Lincoln sometimes receives from young ladies, and the assassination letters more often sent by older men. Typically, the president gets almost 300 letters a day, of which he reads only a half dozen at most. Lincoln skims the mail, then jots down a few notes. Each is signed A. Lincoln. If it is of a more official nature, or just yours truly, as in the case of his note to William Seward. The Secretary of State continues to recover from his horrible accident, his jaw and shattered skull mending slowly. Now he lies in bed at home, a convenient stone's throw across the street from the White House. Breakfast is scheduled for 8 o'clock. Lincoln finishes his brief business and enters a small room where he grooms himself. Daily baths and showers are rare, even in the White House. Lincoln is eager to be downstairs, for his son Robert is just back from the war and will be joining him, 12-year-old Tad and Mary, for breakfast. More importantly, Robert was in the room when Lee surrendered at Appomattox. Though Lincoln heard the story from Grant yesterday, he is keen to hear more about the landmark event. The war's end is one topic he never gets tired of talking about. Just 21, with a thin mustache and a captain's rank, Robert is still boyish despite his time at the front. As Lincoln sips coffee and eats the single boiled egg that constitutes his daily breakfast, Robert describes the stately, elegant Lee and Grant, the small, stooping, shabby, shy man in the muddy blue uniform with no sword and no spurs. When Lincoln asks what it was like to be there, his son is breathless. "Oh, it was great," the normally articulate Robert exclaims, unable to find a more expressive way to describe being present at one of the most seminal moments in American history. Robert hands Lincoln a portrait of Lee. The president lays it on the table, where it stares up at him. Lincoln tells his son that he truly believes the time of peace has come. He is unfazed by the small but bitter Confederate resistance that remains. His thoughts are far away from the likes of John Wilkes Booth. Pressing business awaits Lincoln in his office, but he allows breakfast to stretch on for almost an hour. He can permit himself this luxury with the war finally over. At last he stands, his body stooped, now just an inch or two less than the towering height of his youth. He is relaxed and happy, even though his severe weight loss makes him look like a skeleton with clothes, in the words of one friend. Lincoln reminds Mary that they have a date for a carriage ride this afternoon. To Robert, he suggests that the time has come to remove the uniform, return to Harvard, and spend the next 3 years working on his law degree. At the end of that time, I hope we will be able to tell if you will make a good lawyer or not, he concludes, sounding more serious than he feels. The words are a sign that he is mentally transitioning from the easy part of his day into those long office hours when, even with the war concluded, the weight of the world presses down on his shoulders. By 9 a.m., President Lincoln is sitting at his desk in the Oval Office. Every aspect of Lincoln's early morning has the feel of a man putting his affairs in order, reading the Bible, jotting a few notes, arranging for a last carefree whirl around Washington with his loyal wife, and setting his son on a path that will ensure him a successful future. All of this is done unconsciously, of course, but it is notable. Even if it is not mentioned on this day in the White House, the potential assassination of the president is a topic of discussion in and around Washington. The chattering class doesn't know when it might occur, but many believe an attempt will come very soon. To those familiar with the city of Washington, a member of his cavalry detail will later write, it was not surprising that Lincoln was assassinated. The surprising thing to them was that it was so long delayed. It is probable that the only man in Washington who, if he thought upon the subject at all, did not think that Mr. Lincoln was in constant and imminent danger, was Mr. Lincoln himself. But today, it is as if Lincoln subconsciously knows what is about to happen. A mile down Pennsylvania Avenue, the man who does know what is about to happen is also setting his affairs in order. Chapter 28, Friday, April 14th, 1865, Washington, 9 a.m. John Wilkes Booth walks slowly down the hotel corridor, momentarily at a loss for words. He has come to say goodbye to his beloved Lucy. He struggles to think of a way to break off their secret engagement and intimate that he may never see her again. Even though their relationship has been all but dead since Newport, of all the terrible things he must do today, what he is about to do next breaks his heart like no other. The Hales are living in the National Hotel on the corner of Pennsylvania and 6th. Booth lives in the same hotel, room 228. Lucy does charity work for the Sanitation Committee and even rode to the front lines of nearby battlefields to visit the troops. It's well known that her father wishes her to marry someone powerful and well-connected. For Lucy to not only slink off to the room with an actor, but also to agree to marry him, would enrage Senator Hale. So while the relationship has slowly become more public, she and Booth have kept their pending nuptials a secret. It is 9 a.m. when Booth knocks on her door. He wears a ring she gave him as a keepsake. Booth has an eccentric habit of kissing the ring absentmindedly when out drinking with friends, and he does so now, as he nervously waits for her to answer the door. This will be the last time you'll see her for quite a while, perhaps forever. Lucy's father has been appointed ambassador to Spain, and the entire family will accompany him abroad. Booth plans to escape to Mexico after shooting Lincoln, and then perhaps sail to Spain for a clandestine visit with Lucy, that is, if all goes well. But how to say goodbye? How to make the next few moments as touching, as romantic, as any farewell should be, while also not letting her know he's leaving and why? Their relationship began in 1862. Booth became enchanted after glimpsing her in a crowd and sent Lucy an anonymous Valentine's Day love letter. This was followed shortly afterward by another missive revealing his identity. If its intended effect was to make 21-year-old Lucy swoon, it worked. Booth was at the height of his fame and good looks, delighting women across the country with his performance as the male lead in a traveling production of Romeo and Juliet. One actress even tried to kill herself after he rebuffed her advances. But Lucy Lambert Hale was not in the habit of throwing herself at men. So while Booth might have had the upper hand at the start, she made him work hard for her affection. The relationship simmered for 2 years, starting with flirtation and then blossoming into something more. The pair became intimate. When he was on the road, Booth was as faithful as a traveling thespian could be, which is to say that he made love to other women, but considered them second to Lucy in his heart. Booth is not the sort of man to mean it when he says, "I love you." For the most part, women are the objects of his own gratification. But Lucy has long treated men the same way, holding them at arm's length emotionally, basking in their charms, and then discarding them when someone newer and better comes along. In each other, Booth and Lucy met their match. But they are also opposite in many ways. She comes from a more elite level of society, one that does not consider acting a gentlemanly career. She's an abolitionist, and he is most certainly not. He professes a heartfelt belief in the Southern cause, while she is the daughter of a ferociously partisan Northern senator. The engagement is doomed. Booth has not seen Lucy since their ill-fated getaway to Newport. They haven't so much as exchanged letters or passed each other in the hallway, even though they live in the same hotel. He has no idea how she will react to his visit. A servant answers the door and ushers him inside the suite. Lucy appears a moment later, the unfinished business of their argument hanging between them. They both know it's over. Nothing more needs to be said, much to Booth's relief. They make small talk, skirting the obvious issue. And then it is time to say goodbye. Before leaving, Booth asks Lucy for a photograph so that he might have something to remember her by. She steps out of the room and returns with a small portrait of her face in profile. Her hair is pulled back off her forehead, and her lips are creased in a Mona Lisa smile. Booth thanks Lucy and gives her a long last look. He then turns and walks out of the Hale suite, explaining breezily that he's off to get a shave, wondering if he will ever make it to Spain to see Lucy again. As he walks back down the hallway, the sound of the closing door still echoing in the corridor, Booth admires the picture and slips it into his breast pocket next to the picture of four other women who have enjoyed his charms. The life of a narcissist is often cluttered. The pictures will remain in Booth's pocket for the rest of his short life. Chapter 29, Friday, April 14th, 1865, Washington, 10 a.m. Mary Lincoln has tickets for a play, and what a spectacular performance it will be. Grover's Theater is not only staging a lavish production of Aladdin or The Wonderful Lamp, but is adding a grand finale for this night only, during which the cast and audience will rise as one to sing patriotic songs written especially for the occasion. Everyone in Washington is talking about it. But Mary is torn. Word has come from James Ford, the manager of Ford's Theater, that he is staging a wildly popular farce, Our American Cousin. Tonight, the legendary actress Laura Keene is celebrating 1,000 performances of her signature role as Florence Trenchard. This milestone, Ford has politely suggested to Mary, is something not to be missed. Keene, 38, is not only one of America's most famous actresses, but also very successful as a theater manager. In fact, she is the first woman in America to manage her own high-profile career and purchase a theater. That theater will later be renamed the Winter Garden and is still in existence today at a different location in New York City. Offstage, Laura King's life is not so tidy. She pretends to be married to her business manager, but in truth, she is secretly married to a convicted felon who has run off to Australia. During an extended tour of that faraway continent, Keene quarreled mightily with her co-star, the equally vain Edwin Booth. But on stage, Laura Keene is a force. The gimlet-eyed actress owes much of that success to Our American Cousin. At first, she thought very little of the script, which places a country bumpkin in the upper class of British society. But then Keene changed her mind and bought worldwide rights. Debuting 7 years earlier at Laura Keene's Theater on Broadway, it soon became the first blockbuster play in American history. It was performed in Chicago on the same night in May 1860 that Lincoln was confirmed as a Republican nominee for the presidency. Many of the play's screwball terms like sockdologizing and Dundreariisms, named for the befuddled character Lord Dundreary, have become part of the cultural lexicon, and several spin-off plays featuring characters from the show have been written and performed. Despite all that, ticket sales for this run of the play have been sluggish, and Ford's might be nearly empty this evening. But Mary Lincoln doesn't mind. What matters most to her is that on this patriotic of evenings, she and the president will celebrate their first visit to the theater since the war's end by enjoying the quintessential American comedy on a night that features one of America's, if not the world's, most famous actresses. Aladdin can wait. With this sudden and impulsive decision to attend one show and not the other, an eerie coincidence will unravel. Thanks to the performance that took place in Chicago in 1860, Our American Cousin will bracket both the beginning and the end of the Lincoln administration. Over breakfast a few hours earlier, Mary told the president that she wanted to go to Ford's. Lincoln absentmindedly said he would take care of it. Now, between Oval Office appointments, Lincoln summons a messenger. He wants a message delivered to Ford's Theater, saying that he will be in attendance this evening if the state box is available. General Grant and his wife will be with him, as will Mary. Abraham Lincoln is the undisputed leader of the world's most ascendant nation, a country spanning 3,000 miles and touching two oceans. During the war, he could send men off to die with a single command to his generals. He has freed the slaves. This is a man who has the power to do almost anything he wants. And tonight, if truth be told, he would prefer to see Aladdin. Yet Lincoln would never dream of contradicting Mary's wishes. His life is much easier when she is appeased. A volatile and opinionated woman whose intellect does not match her considerable capacity for rage, Mary Lincoln is short and round, wears her hair parted straight down the middle, and prefers to be called Madam President, which some believe is pretentious, to say the least. Mary's rants about some person or situation that has angered her can sidetrack Lincoln's day and drain him of precious energy. So he does all he can to make sure nothing upsets her unstable psyche. But to be fair, Mary Lincoln has also suffered the deaths of two young sons during her 22-year marriage. Lincoln dotes on her. A compassionate man, he tries more to ease the lingering pain than to merely keep the peace. Mary Lincoln is almost 10 years younger than her husband, and they had an on-again, off-again courtship, and even broke off their first engagement when Lincoln had cold feet about marrying her. Mary is from an affluent home, which afforded her an education that few American women enjoyed at the time. Lithe in her early 20s, Mary has put on considerable weight, and though she had many suitors as a young woman, few would now consider her to be good-looking. Nevertheless, Lincoln is enamored. The president considers Mary the love of his life. Some historians believe that because Lincoln lost his mother at the age of 9, he was drawn to women with maternal protective instincts. Mary Lincoln certainly fits that description. Lincoln is overdue at the War Department. He also has a cabinet meeting scheduled in just over an hour. He hurriedly steps out of the White House and walks over to see Stanton. Mary demands that he wear a shawl, and so he does, not caring the slightest that the gray garment draped over his shoulders gives him a decidedly non-presidential appearance. Lincoln strolls into Stanton's office unannounced, plops down on the couch, and casually mentions that he's going to the theater that night. The words are designed to provoke a reaction, and they do. Stanton frowns. His network of spies have told him of assassination rumors. Last night, during the illumination party at his home, Stanton adamantly warned Grant away from going to the theater with the Lincolns. Stanton is no less stern with Lincoln. He thinks the president is a fool for ignoring the assassination rumors and argues that Lincoln is risking his life. At least bring a guard with you, Stanton pleads, once it becomes obvious that Lincoln will not be dissuaded. That statement is the best evidence we have that Secretary of War Stanton did not wish Lincoln ill. If, as some conspiracy theorists believe, Stanton wished Lincoln dead, why would he want to provide him with protection? The president is in a playful mood. Stanton, Lincoln says, did you know that Eckert can break a poker over his arm? Major Thomas T. Eckert is the general superintendent of the Military Telegraph Corps. He once demonstrated the shoddy nature of the War Department's fireplace irons by breaking the defective metal rods over his left forearm. Why do you ask such a question? Stanton replies, mystified. Stanton, I believe I have seen Eckert break five pokers, one after the other, over his arm, and I am thinking that he would be the kind of man who would go with me this evening. May I take him? Major Eckert has a great deal of work to do. He can't be spared. Well, I will ask the major himself, Lincoln responds. But Eckert knows better than to cross Stanton. Despite a barrage of good-natured pleading by the president, Eckert says he cannot attend the theater that evening. His business with Stanton concluded, Lincoln wraps the shawl tightly around his shoulders and marches back to the White House for his cabinet meeting. Chapter 30. Friday, April 14th, 1865, Washington, 10:30 a.m. Lincoln's messenger reaches Ford's at 10:30 a.m. The President of the United States would like to formally request the State Box for this evening, if it is available, the note reads. The State Box is available. James Ford immediately responds, barely containing his excitement. He races into the manager's office to share the good news with his brother Harry, and then barks the order for the stage carpenter to come and see him right this instant. Ford's may be the city's preeminent stage, but business has been extremely slow this week. The post-war jubilation means that Washington's theatergoers are making merry on the streets, not penned together, inside watching a show. In fact, Ford had been anticipating yet another dismal night. Our American cousin is no match for the Grover's Aladdin, which is made all the more spectacular by the post-show victory rally, thus allowing audience members to watch a play and make merry. Ford can almost hear the actor's words echoing off empty seats and the punchlines that will achieve a yawn instead of the guffaw packed and energized theater so often guarantees. But now with word that the president will be in the audience, the night should be a sellout. Ford's was originally known as the First Baptist Church of Washington. When the Baptists moved out in 1861, James' brother John purchased the building and turned it into a playhouse. When Ford's Athenaeum was destroyed by fire in 1862, some said it was God's will, because many churchgoers considered the theater to be the devil's playground. But John Ford was undeterred. He not only rebuilt the great brick building, he reshaped it into the nation's most modern theater. Ford's reopened to rave reviews in August 1863. The building is flanked on either side by taverns, the Greenback Saloon to the left and Taltaval's Star Saloon to the right, so the theatergoers can pop next door for a drink at intermission. The outside of the theater itself features five decorative archways. Patrons enter through the center arch, leading directly into the ticket booth and lobby. The steps leading up from the street are granite. The unpaved streets are often muddy this time of year, so Ford has built a wooden ramp from the street into the lobby. This ensures that ladies won't soil their evening wear when stepping out of their carriages. Inside, three seating levels face the stage. Gas lamps light the auditorium until the curtain falls, when they are dimmed by a single backstage valve. The chairs are a simple straight-back cane, but inside his special presidential box, Lincoln prefers to sit in the red horsehair upholstered rocking chair that Ford's reserves for his personal use. Boxes on either side of the stage allow the more privileged patrons to look straight down onto the actors. The state box, where the Lincolns and Grants will sit this evening, is almost on the stage itself, so close that if Lincoln were to impulsively rise from his rocking chair and leap into the actor's midst, the distance traveled would be a mere 9 feet. The state box is actually 2 side-by-side boxes. When not being used by the president or some other national dignitary, they are available for sale to the general public and simply referred to as boxes 7 and 8. A pine partition divides them. On nights when the Lincolns are in attendance, the partition is removed. Red, white, and blue bunting is draped over the railing, and a portrait of George Washington faces out at the audience, designating that the President of the United States is in the house. Out of respect for the office, none of the other boxes are for sale when the Lincolns occupy the state box. Now, with the news that this will be such a night, the first thing on James Ford's mind is decorating the state box with the biggest and most spectacular American flag he can find. He remembers that the Treasury Department has such a flag. With government offices due to close at noon for the Good Friday observance, there's little time to spare. By sheer coincidence, John Wilkes Booth marches up those granite front steps at that very moment. Like many actors, he spends so much time on the road that he doesn't have a permanent address. So Ford's Opera House, as the theater is formerly known, is his permanent mailing address. As James Ford reacts to Lincoln's request, a rehearsal for Our American Cousin is taking place. The sound of dramatic voices wafts through the air. The show has been presented 8 previous times at Ford's. But Laura Keene isn't taking any chances with cues or blocking. If this is to be her 1,000th performance, and perhaps final performance of this war horse, she will see to it that the cast doesn't flub a single line. This bent toward perfectionism is a Keene hallmark and a prime reason she has enjoyed such a successful career. Booth's mail is in the manager's office. As he picks up a bundle of letters, stage carpenter James J. Clifford bounds into the room, curious as to why Ford wants to see him. When the theater manager shares the exciting news about the Lincolns, Clifford is ecstatic. But Booth pretends not to hear, instead staring straight down at his mail, acting as if he's studying the return addresses. He grins, though he does not mean to. He calms himself and makes small talk with Ford, then says his goodbyes and wanders out into the sunlight. Booth sits on the front step, half reading his mail and laughing aloud at his sudden good fortune. Ford walks past, explaining he is off to purchase bunting and perhaps a 36-star flag. Until this moment, Booth has known what he wants to do and the means with which he will do it, but the exact details of the murder have so far eluded him. Sitting on the front step of Ford's Theater on this Good Friday morning, he knows that he will kill Lincoln tonight, and in this very theater. Booth has performed here often, and is more familiar with his hidden backstage tunnels and doors than he is with the streets of Washington. The twofold challenge he now faces is the traditional assassin's plight. Find the most efficient path into the state box in order to shoot Abraham Lincoln, and then find the perfect escape route from the theater. The cast and crew at Ford's treat Booth like family. His eccentricities are chalked up to him being a famous actor. The theatrical world is full of 100 guys just as unpredictable and passionate, so nobody dreams that he has a burning desire to kill the president. So it is, as Booth rises to his feet and wanders back into the theater to plan the attack, that it never crosses anyone's mind to ask what he's doing. It's just John being John. The seats are all empty. The house lights are up. On stage, the rehearsal is ending. John Wilkes Booth prowls Ford's Theater alone, analyzing, scrutinizing, estimating. His journey takes him up the back stairs to the state box, where he steps inside and looks down at the stage. A music stand provides an unlikely burst of inspiration. He hefts it in his hand, nervous but elated, knowing how he will make use of it tonight. By the time he is done, Booth has come up with an audacious and brilliant plan of attack. On Booth's mind are these questions. Will he commit the perfect crime, and will he go down in history as a great man? Chapter 31, Friday, April 14th, 1865, Washington, 11 a.m. A hazy sun shines down on Washington's empty streets. The city is so quiet it seems to be asleep. The Good Friday observance means that its citizens are temporarily done celebrating the war's end. They are now in church or at home repenting, leaving the local merchants to lament the momentary loss of the booming business they've enjoyed the past few days. Hundreds of miles to the south, in Fort Sumter, South Carolina, a massive celebration is about to take place, commemorating the raising of the Stars and the Stripes. Major General Robert Anderson stands before 4,500 people as the very flag that was lowered there 4 years earlier, marking the beginning of the war, now climbs the flagpole. A minister offers a prayer of thanksgiving. The Union is reunited. Back in Washington, General Grant walks to the White House, feeling conflicted. He was supposed to meet with Lincoln at 9 a.m., but the president rescheduled for 11 so that Grant can attend the cabinet meeting. Now he feels obligated to attend the theater tonight with the Lincolns. But Julia Grant, who thinks Mary Lincoln is unstable and a gossip, has bluntly refused. When the theater invitation arrived from Mary Lincoln earlier that morning, Julia replied with a firm no, stating that the Grants would be leaving town that afternoon and noting, "We will not, therefore, be here to accompany the President and Mrs. Lincoln to the theater." She is, in fact, adamant that they catch the afternoon train out of Washington. Going to the theater with Mary Lincoln is out of the question. General Grant is caught in the middle. Lincoln has become such an ally and dear friend that turning down his invitation seems rude. But displeasing his wife, who has endured many a sacrifice these past years, is equally daunting. The two soldiers standing guard at the White House gate snap to attention as their general-in-chief arrives. Grant tosses them a return salute with the casual ease of a man who has done it thousands of times, never breaking stride as he continues onto the front door. The doorman nods graciously as Grant steps inside, dressed in his soldier's uniform, moving past the police bodyguard currently on duty, and a rifle-bearing soldier also in dress uniform. Then it's up the stairs to Lincoln's second-floor office, where another soldier stands guard. Soon, Grant is seated in Lincoln's cabinet meeting, somewhat surprised by the loose way in which such matters are conducted. He assumed that Lincoln's entire cabinet would be in attendance, particularly since there are so many pressing matters of state to discuss. But a quick glance around the room shows no sign of Secretary of War Stanton or Secretary of the Interior John Usher. Secretary of State William Seward, home recovering from his carriage accident, is represented by his son Frederick. And as Lincoln leans back in his chair along the south window, the half-filled room feels more like a collegiate debating club than a serious political gathering. Lincoln guides the dialogue, which jumps from elation at the war's end to other topics and back, taking no notes as he soaks in the various opinions. His behavior is that of a first among equals rather than the ultimate decision maker. The meeting is into its second hour as Grant is shown into the room, and his entrance injects a new vitality, just as Lincoln intended. The cabinet, to a man, is effusive in praise of the general and begs to hear details of the Appomattox surrender. Grant sets the scene, describing the quaint McLean farmhouse and the way he and Lee sat together to settle the country's fate. He doesn't go into great detail, and he makes a point of praising Lee. The cabinet members are struck by his modesty, but clamor for more. Lincoln tries to draw Grant out. "What terms did you make for the common soldier?" the president asks, already knowing the answer. "To go back to their homes and families, that they would not be molested if they did nothing more." There is a point to Lincoln's inviting Grant to this meeting, as evidenced by this new line of inquiry. Lincoln hopes for a certain pragmatic lenience toward the southern states rather than a draconian punishment, as his vice president, Andrew Johnson, favors. Lincoln has not seen Johnson since his second inauguration. But Lincoln's lenient plan for the South is not born solely out of kindness, nor with just the simple goal of healing the nation. The South's bustling warm-water ports and agricultural strength will be a powerful supplement to the nation's economy. With the nation mired in more than $2 billion of wartime debt, and with Union soldiers still owed back pay, extra sources of income are vitally needed. Grant's simple reply has the desired effect. Lincoln beams as the cabinet members nod their heads in agreement. "And what of the current military situation?" Grant says that he expects word from Sherman any minute, saying that General Joe Johnson has finally surrendered. This, too, is met with enthusiasm around the table. Throughout the proceedings, Grant's feeling of unease about the evening's plan lingers. He makes up his mind to tell Lincoln that he will attend the theater. Doing otherwise would be ungracious and disrespectful. Julia will be furious, but eventually she will understand. And then, first thing in the morning, they can be on the train to New Jersey. The cabinet meeting drags on. 1 o'clock rolls past, 1:30. A messenger arrives carrying a note for Grant. It's from Julia, and she's not happy. Mrs. Grant wants her husband back at the Willard Hotel immediately, so they can catch the 6 p.m. to Burlington, New Jersey. General Grant's decision has now been made for him. After months and years of men obeying his every order, he bows to an even greater authority than the President of the United States, his own wife. "I'm sorry, Mr. President," Grant says when the cabinet meeting ends, just after 1:30. "It is certain that I will be on this afternoon's train to Burlington. I regret that I cannot attend the theater." Lincoln tries to change Grant's mind, telling him that the people of Washington will be at Ford's to see him. But the situation is out of the general's hands. Lincoln senses that and says goodbye to his dear friend. The Grants will make their train. Julia is so eager to leave town that she has chosen the local, which takes 13 long hours to reach Burlington. The faster option would be the 7:30 express in the morning, but that would mean a night at the theater with the daft and unbalanced Mary Lincoln. Julia Grant's mind is made up. What Ulysses S. Grant does not know is that he will be returning to Washington by the same train within 24 hours. Chapter 32, Friday, April 14th, 1865, Washington, 2 p.m. 2,000 years after the execution of Jesus, there are still many unanswered questions about who was directly responsible for his death and what happened in the aftermath. And so it is on Good Friday, 1865, that a series of bizarre occurrences will take place. In the hours to come, guards will inexplicably leave their posts. Bridges that should be closed will miraculously be open. And telegrams alerting the army to begin a manhunt for Lincoln's killer will not be sent. All happenings that have been tied to a murky conspiracy that most likely will never be uncovered. What we do know is that in these hours, John Wilkes Booth is putting the final touches on his murderous plan. Booth is on an emotional roller coaster, his spirits rising and falling as he ponders the assassination and its consequences, all the while running down his checklist, completing the task that must be done for tonight. He is dressed in dashing fashion, with tight black pants, a tailored black coat, and a black hat. With those clothes and his broad black mustache, he couldn't look more like a villain. The only thing he wears that isn't black are his boots. They're tan. The first stop is Mary Surratt's boarding house on H Street. She is walking out of the door for a trip into the country to collect an old debt. But Booth catches her just in time. He hands her a spyglass wrapped in brown paper and tied with a string, telling her to make sure it doesn't get wet or break. One of Surratt's tenants, Louis Whiteman, is a soldier and government clerk whose job deals with the care and housing of prisoners of war. Whiteman senses there's something shady about Booth, having listened to his rants and spent enough time around the Surratts to discern the pro-Confederate leanings of the crowd. So he leans in to eavesdrop as Mary and Booth confer by the marble fireplace. Mary catches him. She calmly orders Whiteman to leave their house at once and pick up a horse and buggy for her journey. By the time Whiteman returns with the horse and buggy, Booth is gone, walking the 5 blocks to the Herndon house where Lewis Powell is lying on a bed, staring at the ceiling. He and Booth discuss the evening's plan. The trick in killing Secretary of State Seward, Booth reminds him, isn't the actual murder. Seward is barely conscious and in great pain after his carriage accident. He is incapable of putting up any resistance. No, the hard part will be getting in and out of Seward's home. There is at least one male military nurse to protect the secretary, along with Seward's wife and 3 of his children. In a worst-case scenario, Powell will have to kill all of them, Booth says. Powell, mentally impaired since that long-ago mule kick to the head, says he has no problem with mass murder. Then Booth is on the move again, headed for Pomfrey's stable to arrange for his getaway horse. He prefers a small sorrel, but it's already gone for the day. Instead, Booth rents a compact bay mare with a white star on her forehead. Pomfrey warns Booth that although the mare is just 14 hands high, she's extremely high-spirited. She mustn't be tied to a post if he leaves her anywhere, because she'll pull away and escape. Better to have someone hold the reins at all times. The bay tries to bite Booth as the groom cinches the English saddle under her belly and adjusts her stirrups. To demonstrate her high spirits, the groom smacks the mare on the rump. She jumps and kicks, much to Booth's delight. Booth saddles up. He likes the horse and the black mane and tail, but the stirrups don't feel right. The groom shortens them one notch, and Booth is on his way, walking the mare up 6th Street to Pennsylvania Avenue, where he jabs his spurs into her flank so she'll run. It's a ludicrous idea. The street is jammed with pedestrians and carriages. Union soldiers returning from the front march in loose formation, dog-tired and in no mood for a horseman to romp through their ranks. But today, Booth is above the law. He gallops the bay down Pennsylvania, ignoring the angry curses hurled in his mud-splattered wake. Booth stops at Grover's Theater, where the marquee announces the gorgeous play of Aladdin or The Wonderful Lamp. He doesn't have any business there, but theaters are safe, no matter what city he's visiting. Booth knows not only the insides of the building, but also each nearby bar and restaurant where he's sure to see a friendly face. On a day like today, when his stomach is churning and he's battling with all his might to stay calm and focused, nothing could be more natural than making his way to a theater, just to experience a few moments of calm reassurance. For the child of actors raised on grease paint and footlights, it's like going home. Against Pumphrey's explicit direction, he ties the mare to a hitching post, then wanders up to Deary's Tavern and orders a bottle. Alone at the bar, nursing a brandy and water to the sounds of the clacking of billiard balls from a nearby table, he pauses to reflect on what he's about to do. Getting into the theater should be easy enough. Getting past the bodyguard at the door to the state box, however, might get bloody, and the odds of killing Lincoln and escaping are low. Booth accepts all that. But what if nobody knows it's him? What if the euphoric triumph of shooting Lincoln is followed by the devastating letdown of anonymity? That is, until he reaches some safe refuge, where he can shout his accomplishment to the world, and then parlay his infamy into some even greater glory. But what if nobody believes him? What if John Wilkes Booth shoots the president and makes a clean getaway, only to be ignored when he tells everyone he's the man who did it? This cannot be. Booth craves the limelight too much. He needs to make sure he'll get immediate credit for such a bold and dramatic act. Booth tosses a dollar onto the bar and walks downstairs to the Grover's manager's office. It's empty. Sitting at the desk, Booth removes paper and envelope from the pigeonholes. He then writes a letter to the editor of the National Intelligencer, stating in specific terms what he is about to do. He signs his name, then adds those of Powell, Azarod, and Harold. They are all members of the same company in theatrical terms. They deserve some sort of billing, even if they might not want it. After sealing the envelope, Booth steps outside. He's pleased to see that his feisty bay is still where he left her. A motley and dispirited group of Confederate prisoners is marching down the street as he saddles up. "Great God," he moans, mortified by such a sad sight. "I no longer have a country." But seeing those downtrodden rebels is yet another reminder of why Booth has embraced violence. Thus fortified, Booth spies fellow actor John Matthews in front of the theater. Booth leans down from his horse to hand him the envelope and gives him specific instructions to mail it the next morning. However, hedging his bets in case things go bad, Booth says he wants a letter back if he finds Matthews before 10 tomorrow morning. It's a petty and spiteful trick, designed to implicate Matthews, who will be on stage in the role of Richard Coyle during Our American Cousin. Booth had asked him to be part of the conspiracy and was turned down. The night after his aborted kidnapping attempt on Soldiers' Home Road 4 weeks earlier, Booth even lounged on Matthews's bed in a small boarding house across from Ford's Theater, trying to cajole the fellow actor to join him. But Matthews continued to refuse. Now Booth is getting his revenge, implicating Matthews by association. Matthews, completely unsuspecting, is distracted by an unusual sight. "Look," he says to Booth, "over there." Booth is stunned to see General and Mrs. Grant leaving town in an open carriage piled high with luggage. Julia is inside with another female passenger while the General sits up top next to the coachman. Booth trots after them just to see for himself. He parades his horse past the carriage, turns around, and guides the bay back toward the Grants at a walk. He stares as the carriage passes, glaring at Sam Grant with such intensity that Julia will later recall quite vividly the crazed man who stared them down. It is only after the assassination that Mrs. Grant will realize who it was. "I thought he was going to Ford's tonight with Lincoln," Booth says to a stranger. "Somebody said he's going to Jersey," the man responds, confirming Booth's worst fears. Glumly, he realizes that one of his two primary targets will not be at Ford's this evening. He wheels the horse around and heads for that theater. Washington is a relatively small city. All the locations associated with Booth's activities throughout the week are situated close together. Mary Surratt's boarding house is just a few blocks away from the National Hotel, which is just a few blocks from the Kirkwood House, where Vice President Johnson is staying, which is just a few blocks from the White House, which is right across the street from Secretary Seward's home. The National, the White House, and Mary Surratt's boarding house constitute the three corners of a broad triangle. Within that triangle are all the other locations. And in the very center is Ford's Theater, which is right across the alley from the Herndon House, where Lewis Powell is now eating an early dinner of cold beef and potatoes before checking out. The alley is known as Baptist Alley, due to Ford's origins as a house of worship. A maid at Ford's hears the sound of galloping hooves coming from the alley. When she looks outside, she sees a most unusual sight. The famous actor, John Wilkes Booth, racing a horse north up the alley from E Street, then galloping out the other end on F Street. He does this twice. The maid, Margaret Rozier, watches as Booth dismounts after the second dry run of his escape, not in a million years imagining what she has just witnessed. When he's done, Booth stops at Ford's stage door, where he invites stagehands Jim Maddox and Ned Spangler to join him for a drink next door at Jim Ferguson's Greenback Saloon. As they come back outside after their drink, Booth mounts the bay and says hello to Jim Ferguson himself. Ferguson has heard about the Lincolns and is making plans to see our American cousin tonight. "She is a very nice horse," Booth says, noting the way Ferguson admires her. "She can gallop and almost kick me in the back." Booth prods the horse with his spurs and then gallops back to the National Hotel, his errands complete. The energy whooshes out of him as the alcohol wears off and the brute realization of what he is about to do hits him hard. His face is so pale that the desk clerk inquires about his health. Booth says he's fine, orders a cup of tea, and heads upstairs to rest. Chapter 33, Friday, April 14th, 1865, Washington, 3:30 p.m. "Crook," Abraham Lincoln says to his bodyguard, "I believe there are men who want to take my life, and I have no doubt that they will do it." The two men are walking down Pennsylvania Avenue on their way back to the War Department for their second meeting of the day. Lincoln wants a short session with Stanton to discuss the fate of a Confederate ringleader who very recently made the mistake of crossing the border from Canada back into the United States. Stanton is in favor of arresting the man, while Lincoln prefers to let him slip away to England on the morning steamer. As soon as Lincoln makes his point, he aims to hurry back to the White House for the carriage ride he promised Mary. William Crook is fond of the president and deeply unsettled by his comments. "Why do you think so, Mr. President?" Crook steps forward as they come upon a group of angry drunks. He puts his body between theirs and Lincoln's, thus clearing the way for the president's safe passage. Crook's actions, while brave, are unnecessary. If the drunks realize that the president of the United States is sharing the same sidewalk, they give no notice. Lincoln waits until Crook is beside him again and then continues his train of thought. "Other men have been assassinated," Lincoln says. "I hope you are mistaken, Mr. President. I have perfect confidence in those around me, in every one of you men. I know that no one could do it and escape alive," Lincoln says. The two men walk in silence before he finishes his thought. "But if it is to be done, it is impossible to prevent it." At the War Department, Lincoln once again invites Stanton and Telegraph Chief Major Thomas Eckert, the man who can break fireplace pokers over his arms, to attend our American cousin that night. Both men turn him down once again. Lincoln is upset by their rejection, but doesn't show it outwardly. The only indication comes on the walk back to the White House when he admits to Crook, "I do not want to go." Lincoln says it like a man facing a death sentence. Inside the White House, Lincoln is pulled into an unscheduled last-minute meeting that will delay his carriage ride. Lincoln hides his exasperation and dutifully meets with New Hampshire Congressman Edward H. Rollins. But as soon as Rollins leaves, yet another petitioner begs for a few minutes of Lincoln's time. A weary Lincoln, all too aware that Mary will be most upset if he keeps her waiting much longer, gives former military aide, Colonel William Coggeshall, the benefit of a few moments. Finally, Lincoln marches down the stairs and heads for the carriage. He notices a one-armed soldier standing off to one side of the hallway and overhears the young man tell another, "I would almost give my other hand if I could shake that of Lincoln." Lincoln can't resist. "You shall do that, and it shall cost you nothing, boy," he exclaims, broadly smiling, as he walks over and grasps the young man's hand. He asks his name, that of his regiment, and in which battle he lost the arm. Only then does Lincoln say his farewells and step outside. He finds Mary waiting at the carriage. She's in a tentative mood. They've spent so little time alone in the past few months that being together, just the two of them, feels strange. She wonders if Lincoln might be more comfortable if they brought some friends along for the open-air ride. "I prefer to ride by ourselves today," he insists. Lincoln helps her into the carriage and then is helped up from the gravel driveway to take his seat beside her. The four-wheeled horse-drawn carriage features two facing double seats for passengers and a retractable roof. The driver sits in a box up front. Lincoln opts to keep the roof open, then covers up their laps with a blanket, even though the temperature is a warm 68 degrees. The war has been hard on their marriage. Mary is delighted beyond words to see that Lincoln is in a lighthearted mood. She gazes into her husband's eyes and recognizes the man who once courted her. "Dear husband," she laughs, "you startle me by your great cheerfulness. I have not seen you so happy since before Willie's death." "And well I may feel so, Mary. I consider this day the war has come to a close." The president pauses. "We must both be more cheerful in the future. Between the war and the loss of our darling Willie, we have been very miserable." Coachman Francis Burns guides the elegant pair of black horses down G Street. The pace is a quick trot. Behind them ride two cavalry escorts just for safety. The citizens of Washington are startled to see the Lincolns out in the town. They hear loud laughter from Mary as the coach passes by and see a grin spread across the president's face. When a group calls out to him as the carriage turns onto New Jersey Avenue, he doffs his trademark stovepipe hat in greeting. Throughout the war, Lincoln has stayed in the moment, never allowing himself to dream of the future. But now he pours his heart out to Mary, talking about a proposed family trip to Palestine, for he is most curious about the Holy Land. And after he leaves office, he wants the family to return to their roots in Illinois, where he will once again hang out his shingle as a country lawyer. The Lincoln and Herndon sign has never been taken down at Lincoln's specific request to his partner. "Mary," Lincoln says, "we have had a hard time of it since we came to Washington, but the war is over, and with God's blessing we may hope for 4 years of peace and happiness, and then we will go back to Illinois and pass the rest of our lives in quiet. We have laid by some money, and during this term we will try to save some more." The carriage makes its way to the Navy Yard, where Lincoln steps on board the USS Montauk. His intent is just a cursory peek at the storied ironclad, with its massive round turret constituting the deck's superstructure. But soon its crew mobs Lincoln, and he's forced to politely excuse himself so he can return to Mary. Unbeknownst to Lincoln, the Montauk will soon serve another purpose. Abraham Lincoln offers a final salute to the many admirers as Coachman Burns turns the carriage back toward the White House. It's getting late, and the Lincolns have to be at the theater. John Wilkes Booth is expecting them. Chapter 34, Friday, April 14, 1865, Washington, 7 p.m. William Crook stands guard outside Lincoln's office door. The 26-year-old policeman and presidential bodyguard has had a long day, having arrived at the White House at precisely 8 a.m. His replacement was supposed to relieve him 3 hours ago, but John Parker, as always, is showing himself to be lazy and unaccountable. Crook is deeply attached to Lincoln and frets about his safety. How this drunken slob Parker was designated as a president's bodyguard is a great mystery, but Crook knows that the president does not involve himself in such things. After their carriage ride, the Lincolns eat dinner with their sons, and then Crook walks the president back to the War Department for a third time that day to see if General Sherman has sent a telegraph stating the disposition of his troops in the South. Lincoln has become so addicted to the telegraph's instant news from the front that he still can't let go of the need for just one more bit of information, even though the prospect of another great battle is slim. Then Crook walks back to the White House with Lincoln, his eyes constantly scanning the crowds for signs that someone means his employer harm. He remembers well the advice of Ward Hill Lehman, the walrus mustache self-appointed head of Lincoln's security detail, that Lincoln should not go out at night under any circumstances, especially to the theater, Lehman had added. But tonight Lincoln is going to the theater, and it's no secret. The afternoon papers printed news about him attending Our American Cousin with General Grant and their wives. Almost as if daring every crackpot and schemer with an anti-North agenda to buy a ticket. Indeed, ticket sales have been brisk since the announcement and recent outpourings of affection notwithstanding. Lincoln's status as the most hated man in America certainly means that not everyone at Ford's will be there out of admiration for the president. Lincoln, however, doesn't see it like that. Even though Mary says the carriage ride gave her a headache, and that has her second-guessing the night out, the president feels obligated to go. He might feel differently if he hadn't missed the grand illumination last night. That, plus the fact that the Grants aren't going, makes Lincoln's obligation all the more urgent. He knows his constituents will be deeply disappointed if both of America's two most famous men fail to appear. And then there's the minor issue of disappointing the Grants' last-minute replacements. Just when it seemed like everyone in Washington was terrified of attending the theater with the Lincolns, Mary found guests, the minor diplomat Major Henry Reed Rathbone and his fiancée and stepsister, Clara Harris, who watched Lincoln's speech with Mary 3 nights ago. Mary is deeply fond of Clara, the full-figured daughter of Senator Ira Harris of New York. They enjoy an almost mother-daughter relationship. Just as important, Major Rathbone is a strapping young man who saw service during the war. He has the sort of physical presence Lincoln might need in a bodyguard, should such services be required. The president doesn't know either of them. When he received the news that this unlikely couple would be their guests, he was enjoying a quiet dinner with Tad and Robert. Lincoln's response was neither joy nor disappointment, but merely a silent nod of acknowledgement. William Crook is a straightforward cop, not one to search for conspiracies or malcontents where none exist. Yet the bodyguard in him wonders about the tall, athletic Rathbone and whether or not he poses a security risk. What better way to kill the president than shooting him in his own box during the play? Finally, Crook hears feet thudding up the stairs. Parker ambles down the hallway, patting the bulge in his jacket just to show that he's armed. He is a 34-year-old former machinist from Frederick County, Virginia, and the father of 3 children. Parker served in the Union Army for the first 3 months of the war, then mustered out to rejoin his family, and took a job as a policeman in September 1861, becoming one of the first 150 men hired when Washington formed its brand-new Metropolitan Police Department. Throughout his employment, Parker's one distinguishing trait has been an ability to manufacture controversy. He's been disciplined for, among other things, swearing at a grocer, swearing at a supervising officer, insulting a woman who had requested police protection, and being drunk and disorderly in a house of prostitution. At his trial, the madam testified that not only was Parker drunk and disorderly, but that he had been living in the whorehouse for 5 weeks before the incident. Apparently, the authorities chose to ignore that testimony. The trial took place before a police board rather than in criminal courts. The board found no wrongdoing by Parker and quickly acquitted him. And so Parker continued his questionable behavior. He appeared before the police board just 2 weeks later for sleeping on duty. 90 days after that, another police board, this time for using profane language to a private citizen. Both charges were dismissed. His innocence proven again and again, Parker had no qualms about putting his name into the pool when late in 1864, the Metropolitan Police Department began providing White House bodyguards. It was prestigious duty and kept him from being drafted back into the Army. Mary Lincoln herself wrote the letter exempting him from service. So far, the only blemish on Parker's record while serving the president is a penchant for tardiness, as Crook knows all too well. And when Parker finally appears several hours late for his shift, Crook is upset, but not surprised. Crook briefs Parker on the day's events, then explains that the presidential carriage will be stopping at 14th and H to pick up Major Rathbone and Miss Harris. The presence of 2 additional passengers means there will be no room for Parker. "You should leave 15 minutes ahead of the president," says Crook, pointing out that Parker will have to walk to Ford's theater and that he should arrive before the presidential party in order to provide security the instant they arrive. As Crook finishes, Lincoln comes to his office door. A handful of last-minute appointments have come up, and he is eager to get them out of the way so he can enjoy the weekend. "Good night, Mr. President," Crook says. He and the president have repeated this scene 100 times, with Lincoln responding in kind. Only this time, it's different. "Goodbye, Crook," Lincoln replies. All the way home, that subtle difference nags at William Crook. Chapter 35, Friday, April 14th, 1865, 8 p.m. As Lincoln is bidding farewell to William Crook, Booth is gobbling down a quick dinner in the National Hotel's dining room. Food, sleep, and adrenaline have him feeling sober once more. Our American cousin starts at 8, and his plan will go into action shortly after 10 p.m. If all goes well, any residual effects of the afternoon's alcohol will have worn off by then. In fact, Booth is feeling so good that he starts drinking again. What he is about to do is very grave indeed. Liquid courage will make sure he doesn't get stage fright and miss his cue. That cue is simple. There is a moment in the third act when the actor Harry Hawk, playing the part of Asa Trenchard, is the only person on stage. He utters a line that never fails to make the audience convulse with laughter. "Don't know the manners of good society, eh?" he says to the character of the busybody, Mrs. Mount Chessington, who has insulted him before exiting the stage. "Well, I guess I know enough to turn you inside out, old gal, you sockdologizing old man-trap." The instant that punchline hits home and the Ford's audience explodes, Booth will kill Lincoln. If everything goes according to plan, he will already be concealed inside the safe box. All he needs to do is pull out his derringer and fire. Booth will toss the pistol aside after shooting Lincoln, then use his Bowie knife to battle his way out if cornered. His plan is to keep moving forward at all times. Forward from the back wall of the box, forward to Lincoln's rocking chair, forward up and over the railing, and then down onto the stage, forward to the backstage door, forward to Maryland, and then forward all the way to Mexico, exile and safety. But Booth will stop for an instant in the midst of all that rapid movement. The actor in him cannot resist the chance to utter one last bold line from center stage. After leaping from the balcony, Booth will stand tall and, in his best elocution, announce, "Sic semper tyrannis, thus always to tyrants." The Latin phrase is meant to sound smart, the sort of profound parting words that will echo down the corridors of history. He has stolen it, truth be told, from the state of Virginia. It is the Commonwealth's motto. No matter, the words are perfect. Booth plans to have another last-minute rendezvous with his co-conspirators at 8 p.m. He returns to his room and polishes his derringer, then slips a single ball into the barrel. The gun goes into his pocket. Into his waistband goes the Bowie knife, in its sheath. Outside, he can hear Washington come to life once again, with still more of the endless post-war parties, bonfires, and street-corner sing-alongs that annoy him no end. Booth packs a small bag with a makeup pencil, false beard, false mustache, wig, and a plaid muffler. As he is about to leave the hotel on his deadly errand, he realizes that his accomplices might be in need of firearms, so he slips a pair of revolvers into the bag. Their firepower far exceeds the derringers. And yet what Booth leaves behind is just as powerful. Among the personal effects